This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanna studio today is distinguished international journalist Robert Cox, and we'll be talking about his time as editor of the Buenos Aires Herald during the time of the disappeared. And the association of Mr. Cox with Charleston is an interesting one, which we'll cover, because the newspaper he worked for was owned by the News and Courier of Charleston, South Carolina. And so, Mr. Cox, welcome to the Journal.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about you, your background, and the Charleston connection. Let's start off with Bob Cox.
Well, I was born in London, 1933, the year that Hitler came to power, and I kind of realized over my years since then that it had some kind of significance, which continued to the time when I got to Argentina in very difficult circumstances, which had echoes of Hitler's rise to power. But my connection with Charleston is a wonderful one. One, because when we were in great danger, we were eventually able to come here. And two, because it's a romantic story of how Peter Manigo came down to an enormous meeting of top media people, Catherine Graham, everybody was there in Buenos Aires, and he looked at this paper and he decided to buy it. I say to people jokingly, like you or I might buy a pair of shoes, but it wasn't quite like that.
And what year was that they bought the paper?
That was 1968.
So 1968.
Yeah, when I had just been appointed editor, I expected to be fired immediately, because that's what you usually do when you buy a newspaper, you fire the editor, and they didn't. We got on wonderfully well. He said, you know, I want to improve the paper. And he said something that was very interesting, really, which didn't go down too well with the staff. We had a kind of a, it wasn't exactly a cooperative, but everybody got a share of the profits. And they said, no, that's not good. You have to be not working in the hope that you're going to get a share of the profits. You have to be just working for it, and we intend to reinvest all the profits in the newspaper, which is what they did. It didn't go down too well to begin with, but it did immediately. They saw that that was exactly what was happening, that everything was going to the paper. The paper was improving all the time. The paper was probably dying when this magnificent man turned up, who had this incredible love for Argentina and for the paper.
All right. Now, I want to back up a little bit on your story, because you were born in Great Britain.
Yeah.
How did you get to Argentina?
I was in Hull, in the north of England, working for the Hull Daily Mail, a great newspaper, and thinking I need to move on somewhere. And there was a wonderful magazine at that time called World's Press News, which carried news of the world's press, but also carried a wonderful advertising section where they sought journalists to work for them. And there were these incredible papers all over the world, either left there by British colonialism, former British colonies, or in some cases, as in China, you know, the American newspapers were set up. There were English language newspapers all over the world. And I saw this seeking desk assistant for the Buenos Aires Herald. Now, I had some connections with Argentina because my father had visited there when he was an officer, a radio officer on the big liners. And so I was intrigued. But I didn't really intend to stay there. I thought it's a nice stepping off point. I can go around the world.
Well, you know,
itinerant journalist.
you were single at the time.
Yes, exactly.
So, I mean, gosh, a job in Argentina. And just as a historical note, folks, Great Britain's trade connections with Argentina go back to the 19th century when Argentina got independence. And so that's why there were expats living in.
Oh, very much so. It was a large British community at one time, tremendously important. They gave me a second-class passage on the Royal Mail lines. It took us almost a month to get there. I had a dinner jacket to take with me.
A second-class passage.
And a contract for 4 years. And then I'd have my passage paid back to Britain, 4 months paid vacation, and a trip back to Argentina. So wow. It was quite an extraordinary thing. I used to think at that time it was the kind of thing that tea planters used to do, I think. You know, again, it had some suggestion that that's the way they operated, that they believed that they could not get Argentines who could manage the English language and who were journalists, who would work the hours we worked. And we did work incredible hours. We almost lived in the newspaper at that time.
Bob, you're a young man. You see this ad. You take a slow boat to Buenos Aires.
Yes, took a month stopping at all the ports.
How large is your staff there in Buenos Aires at the Herald?
It was very small staff then, probably 12 people at the most, and they would be people, some of them came in part-time. Well, they were bringing new blood in because the editor, who at that time had started off a little bit like me, he read an advertisement somewhere and ended up in China and worked from China, and then he worked in Thailand, and then he worked somewhere else, and then he worked in Chile, and then he came across the Andes to the Buenos Aires Herald. So that was the kind of staff that you had came in. Now, he'd been there for some time by now, and there were some steadies, and the other English language newspaper, which was very important, had folded, and so there were two or three people came over from them. But it was a very, very small staff indeed, with very, very little outside reporting going on apart from community events.
So were you really aimed at just the British community?
Well, the English language, which covered an enormous, because Buenos Aires is a port city and Argentina as a great exporter, and of course enormous natural resources, an extraordinary country with so much to do, you've got a large international community, and the English language is what, you know, brings people together, and the paper was very important to them. And when I became editor, I took on that, and we made a point of covering everything we could. Dutch elections, cricket we'd cover baseball, we'd cover the whole of the sort of international gamut.
Of course, you covered polo as well. I mean,
naturally,
the Argentines are very
horse
much
racing
into,
too.
as well as the English. Did the Herald have its own press, or did?
Yes, it was in the building was an old Italian newspaper which had died, a beautiful sort of Renaissance building, decrepit by that time, printed down below by a cooperative. The Herald escaped being confiscated by Perón. But the building was confiscated by Perón, and he gave the printing plant to a workers' cooperative, and they printed the paper for us.
Young people might not know who Perón was. Señor Perón, the dictator of Argentina.
Yeah, well, he was a popular dictator. He was always elected. He got thrown out by the military, came back after 17 years, still dominates Argentina as a kind of mythical figure. Tremendously important, and of course probably outshone in a way by his sparkling wife, who died at the age of 31, Evita, who of course is the subject of many books, musical, films.
Yeah. Yes, for the younger generation, they can remember.
They probably remember Evita.
Well, yeah, Madonna playing Evita.
Yes, Madonna, who came to Buenos Aires to play the role.
And he emerged as a popular force right at the end of World War II, did
he
not?
Right, yeah. Also with one of the problems that still shadows Argentina, fascism. He was a fascist. He believed in fascism. And he indeed presided over a popular dictatorship until 1955. In Argentina, there is still a tremendous Peronism, anti-Peronism divide. The divide now is between people who supported the variation of Peronism that came in with the Kirchners. That's Nestor Kirchner and his wife,
now,
Cristina.
You were there when the coup overthrew Perón?
No, I was there shortly afterwards. I arrived in 1959. He was overthrown in 1955.
Okay. All right. And there was... Was there a military government after Perón?
Yes.
Okay.
It's called the Liberation Government, the Revolución Libertadora, which in a way it was, because Perón controlled the press totally, confiscated a very great newspaper, La Prensa. The Herald survived, was seen as an opposition newspaper, Perón used to, when people used to come and visit him from abroad, dignitaries of some kind or another, and they would bring up the question of fresh freedom, and he'd say, well, look at this newspaper. Mm-hmm. I think it was a careful newspaper, very prudent at that time, but played a brave role at that time under Perón. Tried to keep things open, tried to keep, you know, a semblance of democracy going on.
Under the liberation government, how did the Herald fare?
We were okay with that. I mean, when I arrived in 1959, one of the things that attracted me very much to the job that they offered me, and they say that this country is now struggling to become a democracy again. And when I arrived, the military had called elections, and Frondizi, Arturo Frondizi, very intelligent man, was the president. And the military were in the process of trying to get rid of him. And most of my coverage as a reporter when I went out, and I tried to go out as much as possible, were covering, there were like 31 attempts to throw him out, to bring him down. And I covered many of those coup attempts, and also saw when he finally was banished to an island after the military took over again.
I don't want to talk about the stereotypical impression of Latin America with the constant coups, but that's what you were facing when you were...
Yes, Argentina is baffling in that way because it has the appearance of being this great city. Buenos Aires is one of the world's great cities, there's no doubt about that. It was built, and I mean, it's astonishing how they managed to do it. And it was built to be greater than Paris. You can imagine being in Buenos Aires. Some places you are in Paris, other places you're in London. You might be in Madrid. It's a city of enormous, first of all, tremendous immigrant influx into Argentina, great builders, and they built these marvelous, and there was massive amounts of money. Mm-hmm. And they tended to build everything. I mean, they built, their answer to the Bois de Boulogne was the Palermo Gardens, which is, I don't know, three or four times bigger. One thing that I like to point out to people who come there, I take and show them what is now the Brazilian embassy, which is a beautiful house, which was built by one of the rich Argentine estancieros. He went to Paris and saw a house he liked. So he talked to an architect in Paris and said, I'd like that house in Buenos Aires, only three times bigger. And that's what happened. And there's this incredible house.
I think one thing folks probably don't realize is that in the late 19th and into the 20th century is how cosmopolitan the Argentines were. This is before the day of air travel. They're having to take the boat
Things that sound impossible but are true. They took cows with them, so they had fresh milk during the journey, and they took their maids and butlers. And in Paris, they enraged the French by lighting their cigars with franc notes.
Let's get into what's kind of the nut of your story, the meat of your story, and that is after one of several coups, opposition politicians, individuals began to disappear. Why don't you set the background for that?
Well, I think the best way to do it is to explain what happened. We were used to military coups. A government, good or bad or indifferent, in some cases they were good. But we were used to these, and you cope with it, and you went on. And usually the military came in. Being military people, they painted things and cleaned up things and eventually called elections because they couldn't handle it. So we thought much the same was going to happen with this coup. Much the same was going to happen. And to begin with, it did start the same way.
And the time frame of this is?
1976. Natural coup was March 23, 1976. March 24, 1976, sorry. Usually, like the usual thing, we had the call from children used to phone up the newspaper to say, you know, is there going to be school tomorrow? Hoping they'd have a holiday. And truly, what happened is military music. Everybody gathers round the Casa Rosada, the pink house, on Plaza de Mayo in the heart of Buenos Aires. And they all gather round and the tanks roll in. They count the number of tanks. Usually the military have already decided what they're going to do. In this case, it seemed to be very similar. It seemed very similar. There'd been tremendous violence before. There'd been a kind of a revolutionary attempt, in a way, I would say that, by guerrilla groups who were called terrorists. In some instances, they were terrorists. They weren't always terrorists. They started off doing very lovely things like hijacking, not lovely things, but Robin Hood type things, like they hijacked a Coca-Cola truck, took it down to the terrible poor districts, the Vita Miseris, they call them, misery villages, and they're terrible places, little shacks put together by people with bits and pieces of what they can get, things like that. And then, of course, it became violent. The violence became, and violence responded to violence. And so the great hope was that the military would come in and stop the violence, that there was an organization operating called the Triple A, which is the Argentine Anti-Communist Alliance, which was already assassinating people on the left, and priests and people like that, somewhat on the left. But Argentina, the left is a very mixed up left. It's mixed up with fascism and Peronism, and Perón was never left wing. He wasn't left wing at all, but he was used by the left. They thought that he would be something. To begin with, they hoped he was going to be like Mao. So you had this very, very violent situation. So I think, honestly, and I've written this and said this many times, it was almost there was a sigh of relief that you could hear in Argentina. Now, since then, friends of mine on the left have said, how could you say such a thing as that? Well, certainly not for them. But we didn't expect what was going to happen would happen. And what happened was is that very quickly we realized the violence was not stopping. The bodies were appearing. And they called us up from Government House on the telephone and said, had a whole list of things we were not allowed to do. So I said to my friend Andrew Graham-Yule, who was the news editor, I said, well, we can't just accept that. Go down to Government House. So he went down and he came back with a list, but it wasn't signed or anything like that. It wasn't on proper paper or anything like that. So we wrote about it in the paper. We said, this is what we've been told we can't publish. And of course, and so then we set out to publish what we believed our readers had to know. To begin with, we were covering the things that we got through agencies. And then we decided that we had to investigate when we received a letter at the newspaper to Andrew Graham-Yule, whose father knew. These were an old Anglo-Argentine couple whose son had suddenly been taken away. And so we went out to find what had happened, and they wrote to us because there was a slight error in the funeral notice, which had been telephoned in. So we went out to find out what had happened, and we met these very distraught old people who kind of didn't want to talk but needed to talk. They needed, and they said, we're just shaking our heads, we just can't understand what happened. And then we looked into it a bit more, and we discovered what had happened, that he was in charge of a laboratory, American-owned laboratory, and he was in charge of it, and he needed to go back to university to get his full degree, because younger people were coming up who could be more qualified than him. He just needed to keep up with things. And so he went back to university to get his degree. That made him suspicious, obviously, so that...
Because he went to the university.
Yeah, and he was mixing with students. And so one morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, they didn't think anything of it. Telephones didn't work in Argentina at that time. You didn't have workable telephones. And so he just thought that something had happened at the laboratory and they needed him to go there. So they looked through the glass of the door and saw these uniformed figures. The uniforms were not really recognizable, but the people behaved reasonably okay. They asked questions, and they said, we just need to ask you a few questions. And the family just didn't know what was happening. And so he didn't turn up. But what did happen was that his body was found in a ditch, and he'd been so badly tortured that he was more dead than alive. Some nuns tried to save him, couldn't do that. And so there was a big funeral. And he was very loved in Sarate, small river port. And on the day of the funeral, something happened that became kind of symbolic in Argentina. Before the coup and continuing after the coup, there were Ford Falcon cars, usually green cars, which had no number plates, which were really death squads operating, and they went around and picked up people. And the day of the funeral, these cars ran by and threw out leaflets. The leaflets were purported to be from the Montonero, which was one of the guerrilla groups or terrorist groups, which tried to cover the whole thing up by saying that he had been a Montonero and that he'd betrayed the organization, so he had been ajusticiado. Justice had been done to him, absolutely. Nobody believed it. Made people more aware of what was happening. And that was the first thing that I had that confirmed to me what was absolutely appalling, followed up quite rapidly afterwards by, I had a very good friend. By that time, we were already worrying. People were coming to us, and or we heard that people had disappeared and were not coming back again, and we weren't quite certain what was happening. And he was the secretary of the Papal Nuncio. His name was Kevin Mullin, Monsignor Kevin Mullin. He was an Irish Vatican diplomat who by that time already had a list of names that he would take to the generals and say, where are they? Tell us what you've done. Where are they? And the military at that time was saying they didn't know anything. They didn't know what it was all about. He called me and he said, you must come, Bob. Something terrible has happened. And he said, you know what happened this morning? I was picked up on the day of the coup. The prefectura, which is the Navy police, were out stopping everybody and asking for their identity cards. And this man said, they took me away. He said, and they tortured me. And they kept saying to me, give me names, give me names. And he said, I just gave names of the most respectable people I could think of, so they'd stop. And he said, I have to tell you that these people, some of them haven't turned up again. I don't know where they are. With these two things, I had a tremendous problem because it was absolutely impossible to publish that in the newspaper. So what I did, I at that time, I realized the best thing to do was to try and get the news out. Outside the country, I worked for the Washington Post, and I wrote two stories. The coup was being described as a bloodless coup, a sort of velvet coup, and that there was still freedom of the press. And I wrote two pieces, one about the state of the press, explaining that what had happened was there was a gentleman's agreement among the major newspapers not to publish anything at all about what was going on. And that far from being a bloodless coup, I disguised some of the incidents that I mentioned to you now so that they wouldn't necessarily be able to get back to people, not that they did. And I published them under my byline. I had a friend in the government who said, how on earth could you do that? And I said, well, it was important that I be absolutely open about this from the start. I think I had a sense that I had a duty to do, quite honestly, now when I look back, to get the news out, because there was total silence in Argentina, and these terrible things were happening, and people refused to see what was happening. They refused to see people being taken off the streets. They refused to see these Ford Falcon cars with these thugs, real thugs, with their machine guns outside, yelling at people. People picked up, and there was a total silence. I realized then that if you ever live in a society where you can't go to your newspaper in the morning or listen to your radio station or see your television, the situation is changing now because of social media, which is interesting, but if you can see something and it's not very wise of you to intervene and you wonder, and if you go back and there's no confirmation of what you've seen, you just don't see anything at all, and you see less and less and less. And explain to me what happened in Germany happened in Germany.
So who now was being identified as the enemy of the government? Politically, left, right, or just anybody?
What happened was is that the decision the military had made was that Argentina had to be saved from, I don't know what exactly, but what they'd started to do then was to pick up, and they stated outright, they said, first of all, we will deal with the terrorists, and then we will deal with the people who are behind the terrorists, and then the people who even think. So what they were after were people who didn't think the way they thought, which meant a large section of the Argentine population. And to begin with, the people who started disappearing more than anywhere else were journalists, about 100 journalists, psychiatrists, teachers. university professors, and one doesn't realize at the time that this is happening, although it's something that's happened in history again and again and again. But it takes some time to realize exactly what's happening. I remember I worked for The Economist too, and The Economist sent a man called Robert Harvey out to take a look at things, and we went out together and we talked to people in the government. And at a point he said, you know, they aren't just interested in returning the country to democracy at all. They're out to change this nation entirely. And they had a belief that they, the Argentine military, were fighting the Third World War against international communism, and that the United States should be on their side in this, and that one day it would be realized what they were doing. So that meant that pretty well everybody who wasn't a Catholic, extreme Catholic, they were all extreme Catholics, would immediately be suspect of thinking the wrong thoughts and therefore aiding the subversion, which is what they called it. They called it subversion. And they had made a decision which eventually the first appointed president, General Jorge Rafael Videla, just before he died, made a semi kind of confession, which wasn't really, in which he said that before the coup came, we decided that between 5,000 and 6,000 people had to be killed outright to get rid of this terrible scourge that they saw as they were mad. I think that's the best explanation of it.
And so that's how that young man who went back to graduate school.
Yeah, he was just one of the innocent people picked up amongst it. Now, certainly, many of the people, I don't know how many, but I knew so much about the completely innocent people were picked up because they went to the wrong address. Also, it started to break down because they started to rob everywhere they went. They stole everything. They did things like stole their car and then came back and asked for the papers of the car so they could resell the car. It was an incredible breakdown of civilization in a very civilized country. And it was quite horrifying. The horrifying, most horrifying thought about it was the silence of justice, of the judges, and of the press. Now, the television and radio were under the control, direct control of the military, but the newspapers were not. And there were some good ones, did something or other, but the major newspapers decided they were not going to. The reason, I think, is that they partly agreed with what the military. I don't think now they would, because the horror of it has come out in every way, and the horror is incredibly horrible. They went in for all kinds of forms of torture, psychological torture. There was a tremendous place called ESMA, which is right in the beautiful place, really. It was the former Navy Engineers School, beautifully laid out. Beautiful. They chose that as their place where they tortured people, where they tried to change them psychologically to get them to write speeches for the Navy commander, a man called Emilio Massera, who himself was planning to become president. And there was a war within the military themselves, and this horror going on. And we in the newspaper decided what we could do was, one, we would give them sermons in our editorials, and secondly, we'd try and save lives. But really, what I must say now, and I mean, I wouldn't have been able to do that if I hadn't have had the support of Peter Manigault and the Manigault family and the entire newspaper in Charleston.
All right. We need to pause a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Robert Cox, international journalist, now adopted Charlestonian, and he was for many years the editor of the Buenos Aires Herald, which was owned by the News and Courier of Charleston, South Carolina. And we've been discussing the troubles in the 1960s and 70s in Argentina. So, Bob, let's get back to your story.
So, how does the terrible fact that people are, and this is where this terrible word comes into the vocabulary, especially in the Spanish language, desaparecidos, that disappeared, which is incredibly difficult to get your head around. There were people disappearing, and So I'd meet people who were finally, having gone everywhere, pleading. They go to the war ministry, as it was called in those days. They go to all the police stations. They go to the church. They'd go everywhere they could, saying, what happened? My daughter was taken away at 3 o'clock in the morning. Where is she? No answer. Nobody knows anything at all about it. So eventually they started to come to us at the Herald. My wife remembers coming back. I forgot my wallet with my identity card in it. So she realized that at home, so she bought it, and she saw this file of people outside the Herald waiting to talk to us. Now, we discussed with them what we could do, because we didn't want to write something that could mean that they were more likely to be killed than otherwise. And sometimes we have these agonizing discussions, which went on for months, about how we can handle this. I would say my experience so far is that if we can publish something as quickly as possible, there's a good chance that the military will surface them. In some cases, let them go free entirely. But that was a very difficult thing to know what to do, because there was a lot of fear by that time, and it was submerged fear. And there was this tremendous self-censorship going on in the media, because they themselves had already become complicit because they were not reporting anything. For example, they didn't publish a letter or anything like that. Eventually, one of the problems was, first of all, to establish that indeed people were disappearing. So you needed lists of names. And so an organization called the Mothers of Place de Mayo, who became very famous, working with a wonderful man called Emilio Mignone, put together a list of all the people disappeared, established exactly, you know, who they were, and they went to a newspaper and they said, will you publish it as an advertisement? That kind of advertisement in Argentina costs twice as much. It's called a solicitada. Mm-hmm. And eventually La Prensa did do it, which was a pretty decent newspaper in many ways. A bit difficult because of their association with the military, but at the same time they published it with tremendous difficulty. The other newspaper refused to publish one for a time, but when they saw the rivals and publisher, they did. So that was one, it was like a light opening. There were two newspapers that had published lists of people who disappeared. At the same time, the US Embassy, thanks to the Carter decision to make human rights a matter of policy, he told all his ministers, as he reminded us recently in Atlanta, when he talked in Atlanta, because he finally was decorated by the Argentine government, he said, I gave all my diplomats, all my ministers, instructions that human rights was to be at the top of the agenda. And so as a result of that, Pat Darien, a wonderful woman from the South who became known during the civil rights era, was appointed Assistant Secretary for Human Affairs, and she appointed a wonderful man called Tex Harris, and he put together a list of disappeared people. He had about 12,000 at one time. And so finally, I was almost there again. It was a bit like having a sigh of relief that the news was somehow getting out, but not properly, not in the way that it should have done. So the military went on killing until I think what happened was, I think the Herald had a certain amount to do with it. I think they did not move against us because they very much wanted the alliance with the United States to continue. They wanted the arms. There were many things that they wanted from the United States. And they also, in a way, wanted U.S. respect. Certain things happened. I think one of the great men on the newspapers, a man called James Nielsen, and he wrote the most wonderful editorials based on the fact that it was a matter of humanity. It was a matter of, you know, there it comes to human rights. So the paper became a guardian of human rights. Again, thanks to the connection with Charleston. And of course, to the Carter administration's decision to make a big point about human rights and using Argentina as really, because it was so appalling what was happening there and what happened. I think it's important to get the horror across because it's difficult to do it because it sounds like fiction and over. But among the other things that they did, when they captured a woman who was pregnant, they would make arrangements for her to have a child, and then they kill her. the child was given to people close to the military. I can remember meeting a Brazilian diplomat, and he kind of poo-pooed everything to me. He said, well, you know, that's what happens in Latin America. But the children, no, that's appalling.
Well, they finally came after you and your family.
Yeah, well, all the time, but in different ways, more so towards the end, which was why we had to leave.
In 1977, they actually detained you.
Yes, yes, that was good. That was because I was able to see inside. Once again, all these things, for a journalist, I could confirm things. The first thing I saw when I was taken there after being having to strip was a huge swastika, which covered an enormous wall. The very entrance covered the whole wall. Just before you went in, there was a door on the side and this huge wall. On it was a swastika, and underneath, Nazi nationalism. Mm. They had little swastikas, some of them, in their lapels. Then I went through very quickly because they wanted to get me out of there. They made a mistake because there was an outcry. If they'd have done it earlier, I would have been squashed like a fly. But I went to one cell. I read all the scratchings on the wall. And there were appeals to their mother, to their children. There was only one political slogan in the first one I was in, and then I was moved to another one, and then another one. Finally, I ended up in a prison called the Hotel Sheraton, because it was a prison where the people who were being held there, who I think were being blackmailed by the military, and they were being kept there, because food was brought in. They had the common prisoners making the food for them. When I arrived at this place, because they were getting rid of me, they were taking me through each place I was. Earlier, I'd heard the screams of the tortured people being tortured. When they got me there, they were eating Spanish omelette cut into little cubes and drinking gins and tonics. These were the special prisoners in this incredible place.
How long were you actually detained?
I was there for, they took me in on Friday, which is the usual thing, because then usually nothing can be done to get you out, and I think they got me out on Monday. Or even, no, they got me out on Saturday. I was just there for one night. They brought a judge in, and he was complaining all the time from his estancia in the country.
Did your wife, Maud, go to the British ambassador? Is that
what? Yeah, the alarm was raised. I believe that Carter called. I'm not certain personally, but Mitterrand, all kinds of people. My wife, of course, and we had friends. We had a friend who was in the government who was very useful for me, because he used to warn me when the generals were getting more and more angry, and then he'd say, well, you know, ease it up a bit. And so I'd try and write an editorial about how nicely they had replanted the flowers in Place de Marge and things like that.
You and Maud were expecting it, so did you all pretty much have a plan if they came to get you, what procedures she would and the children would do?
My wife used to sleep with her clothes on because she did not want to be taken away in a nightgown. I would do silly things like work out that, well, if they came for me, what I'll do is I'll sort of get the elevator to stay between floors, stuff like that. And I would look at, I didn't use my car very much, fortunately, and I used to put little transparent tape around because they used to put bombs under the thing. So, but I didn't expect, one day though, they'd loosened all the bolts on the wheels, and suddenly we were driving along and we see a wheel rolling away ahead of us. Fortunately, we were in a tremendous traffic jam way out in the countryside, off the road and everything, so it didn't happen. No, we didn't have plans, because I didn't want to leave. Maud, she was the one who convinced me that we should go. All kinds of suggestions were made. The Papal Nuncio, Pio Laghi, who I got to like, although he played a very ambiguous role throughout that whole period, he wanted me to stay and send my family away, and I said, well, I'm not a priest. I was a priest, we could think of that, but I'm not. But what happened very quickly, largely as a result, I think, of anger, we had defended Jacobo Timmerman, who had been taken away and tortured and finally got out. We finally helped to bring about a campaign whereby he was under house arrest, and so that he was no longer in these terrible jails and being tortured and everything else like that. And then he was finally, the Supreme Court finally acted and cleared him of all charges, and he was expelled from Argentina to Israel. I think the military was so angry with that that then they turned on me, because they came to get me one day. Fortunately, I wasn't there. Unfortunately, I phoned up home beforehand to find out how things were. And then after that came a letter, a very, very sadistic letter, handwritten letter, on the stationery of the school that my then 11-year-old son went to, Peter.
They sent this letter to your son.
Yeah.
Do you mind if I read the letter?
Oh, no, please, yes.
I have a copy of the letter, this threatening letter from the guerrillas.
It's not from the guerrillas, it's from the military, disguised as the guerrillas.
From the military.
Yeah.
Okay. Dear Peter, we know that you're worried about things that happened to the families of your friends, and that you are afraid that something similar could happen to you and your father. We do not eat children raw at breakfast. Considering the fear you all have, and that your dad is a high-level journalist who is more useful to us alive than dead, we have decided to send you this little note as a warning. For this reason, and in consideration to the work your father does, we offer him, and this is in parentheses, and all of you, Peter, Victoria, Robert, David, and Ruth, the option to leave the country, where you run the risk of being assassinated. Do what you prefer and tell Daddy and Mummy to sell the house and the cars and go to work in Paris in another of the Herald's newspapers. You can also elect to stay here working for human rights, but we do not think that this is what your parents or your aunts and uncles expecting you in England for Christmas would like. A big revolutionary salute to your dad.
These were fraudulent letters that I received over the years, and other editors did too. They were written in the CIDE, which was the State Intelligence Department, and they always pretended they were always on the stationery of the guerrilla groups, the Montaneros or the ERP or whatever they were.
And so after Peter got this letter, was that when you all decided to stay?
Well, no, not quite, no, because okay. I thought I should stay on. And I did not believe that they would do anything to my family. Well, this was a jolt. So what happened next was that they tried to kidnap Maud, crossing the road from our apartment to a little grocery store, which was the other side of the road. She's in the middle of the road, having looked both ways, even though it's a one-way street, and finds herself back boxed in by these sinister cars. When they did this kind of thing, they used to pull out their automatic rifles and load and reload them to make a noise. And her reaction was to say, "Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry." And she said to herself, "All you have to do now is just keep calm, just keep calm." And so I think what happened was they decided they'd made a mistake, because I discovered later that they'd tried to kidnap somebody else who we knew vaguely, thinking that that was the wife of the soccer coach at that time, a man called Minotti, who was a great hero at that time. But they made a mistake and they chose somebody who looked like Minotti's wife, but wasn't. So we think that in this case they decided Maud wasn't. So she went across and she heard a couple saying, who were they trying to chupar? That was the expression they used to do, this chupar, which is like sucking up people in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. And she stayed with the grocer for a few hours and then went back.
And there was an attempt on your life. And after those two, it looked like the threat of you and your family being killed was imminent. That's when you finally decided to leave the country.
Yeah, we did. But we, you know, I wrote a piece and we hoped to come back. And so I spent a lot of time before, and people were very generous to me. I spent a time in Washington at the Wilson Center, funded again by this newspaper and the wonderful Manico family. I was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard, where I studied evil, among other things. Because what happened in Argentina has been described by Argentine philosophers as radical evil. It's when evil goes to the utmost unimaginable extremes, when human beings cease being human beings. And when it's when you know that the word bestial doesn't fit, because it's worse than bestial. It's got to do with the fact that we have all those capabilities as human beings to reason.
Well, the dirty war, the horrors that you lived through, Argentina today is different because you and your family began to return there regularly. You have family there.
Yes.
The city of Buenos Aires has recognized you as an illustrious citizen. And Ma just received an honor from the government, did she not?
From the town or city where her family came from. And she wrote a book about the city, and they made her an illustrious citizen of the city of San Martin.
How does it feel going back and visiting places? Now, you said you live in the same apartment that you did.
Yes, we do, where we married. We managed to keep the same apartment, yeah.
And it doesn't, you don't have flashbacks or?
Yes.
You do?
Yes, all the time. Yeah. It hasn't been resolved. It hasn't been resolved.
Well, Maud has written a book and your son David has written a book. Are you going to write a book?
I've tried not to. I found, because people insisted I should, I tried to write it and I found it just knocked me up. A film has been made now. A very good documentary film, which has been shown here once. It's been shown in Charleston once and should come to the United States fairly soon. It won a prize in Argentina, and I think it, which is called Messenger on a White Horse, which is based on me, which I wasn't very happy to begin with, but it is necessary to tell a story in human terms, and I think it's done very well. I think it's a work of art, quite frankly. And it tells the absolute truth. It has a very important piece on Peter Manigault for what he did, which, as I say, was the reason why it could be done.
In the last few years, the News and Courier has sold the newspaper.
It was just 30 years the newspaper was under the wings of Charleston and looked after in one way or another. If Argentina perhaps had flourished economically, it's feasible the newspaper could have continued without. But I was making losses at one time, I understand.
But the Herald has now ceased publication, has it not?
Yeah, but we've brought out, we've managed to give it a rebirth.
Oh, okay.
We've launched a new newspaper called the Buenos Aires Times, the Bat, which kind of fitted. We didn't know that at the time. It's a weekly newspaper. And it's brought out under the wings of another publisher who has a large publishing company in Argentina, publishes magazines. And he has a weekly newspaper which comes out on Saturday and Sunday, and the Herald is ensconced in the Saturday newspaper. It's a 16-page paper. Believe it or not, four or five of the editors who worked on it are writing for it from time to time. And it's, I think, a very, very fine little newspaper, very necessary.
Bob, I hate to say this, but Alfred's given me the wind-up sign.
It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Are there any last words that you'd like to give our listeners before we sign off today?
Yeah, because I have started to think about those things. For many years, I didn't like to do anything really much in a way. But no, the importance of journalism, tremendously important. If you have a situation where journalists cannot report, whether it's willing or unwilling, but if you're not getting the information to the people, it doesn't matter about, opinions are important, but the most important thing is information. And if people don't get the information, the most terrible things can happen, as they happened in Argentina, and as they clearly happened in Germany. I haven't looked into it, but that's something that I do intend to do, to find out how the press operated in those times. But I've always thought it couldn't happen. I think everybody throughout the world admires the United States for its freedom of expression and for its journalism. I mean, American journalism is a guide stick for all of us. And I think, too, at this particular time, it's tremendously important, tremendously important. Also, I think that it's very worrying when you see journalism used for political motives. And of course, that happened in Argentina, so I have a good knowledge of that. In Argentina, the military, when they were planning a coup, would often create a newspaper just to create the situation in which they could carry out a coup. So the independence of newspapers. And of course, in the case of the Charleston newspapers, the fact that you have this family who are guardians. It's rather like the, you know, the guardians of the guardian of the British Guardian, which is a trust set up by the Scott family. And I think that's, and of course what we have here, which they don't have in Argentina, which is very, very important, is public radio. The magnificent journalism, absolutely magnificent journalism, and totally necessary to have a democracy. If you don't have good journalism, good independent journalism, you don't have democracy.
Robert Cox, renowned international journalist and adopted South Carolinian, thanks so much for being with us today on The Journal. This is Walter Edgar, and normally I say, I hope you enjoyed today's journal, but I'm not sure enjoyed is the term I'd like to use. How about informed, or what did you learn in listening to Bob Cox tell his story about facing the terror of Buenos Aires and Argentina under military government and the thousands of men and women, many of them his friends, who became the disappeared? It's a courageous story. A very courageous story. And as he said, he could not have done what he did in telling the world about the disappeared had it not been for the support of Peter Manigo and the News and Courier of Charleston, South Carolina. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETB Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.